Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
For Memorial Day in 2011 and 2014, Dana Schwann was a featured speaker at a candlelight vigil for prisoners of war and those missing in action. She represented Gold Star Wives of America, an organization for military widows. After her Air Force pilot husband was shot down over North Vietnam, Dana Schwann had become an advocate for public awareness on the issue of POWs and MIAs. She has now written a book of fiction, although much of it is autobiographical, The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows, is written from the perspective of three young wives from different cultural backgrounds as they experience the shock, disbelief, and sadness of becoming young widows. Dana Schwann, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
Well, you were a speaker at these candlelight vigils. Where were they held?
This is in Angel Fire, New Mexico, at a national park that was started by the family of a serviceman killed in Vietnam, and they ended up dedicating the park to National Park Service. So people, and particularly veterans from all over the country, come to this beautiful, beautiful memorial site. I'm sure you can find it online, Angel Fire, New Mexico. It's just a gorgeous, mountainous, wonderful, serene, it's a very special place.
And what was that again? Angel Fire, did you say?
Angel Fire, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And so this is a state park devoted to Vietnam veterans.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It has a chapel. It's open 24/7. It has a bookstore. It has displays of all manner of memorabilia associated with Vietnam soldiers and the women who served as what were called donut dollies. They were the USO women that served over there, as well as nurses. But it's just a wonderful, wonderful educational place to go. Highly, highly recommend that anyone in this area of New Mexico stop in to visit. It's out near Taos, New Mexico.
Well, you know, until I read that in your book, I didn't know there was a national park devoted to Vietnam veterans.
Well, it's very meaningful to the vets, and they come there by the thousands. On motorcycle drives a lot during a Memorial Day weekend, so it's going to be a lot of them there for Memorial Day. They come for Veterans Day and throughout the year.
My guest is Dana Schwann, and she has written a book, The Reluctant Sorority. And you say in your book that that label, The Reluctant Sorority, is not one that you made up. Where did you find that phrase?
The phrase, the reluctant sorority, I first heard from a researcher, a wonderful guy who was going to write a book, and he was researching how missing in action wives and widows handle their situation. And he says, well, you're a member of the reluctant sorority. And I said, what the heck are you talking about? I've never heard that. And he said, oh, Sherry Edwards out in California, whose husband was a POW, used that phrase to describe her group of women who met for support and camaraderie while their husbands were overseas. And it just so happened that her husband was a pilot also, whose plane was shot down in North Vietnam. He was a prisoner of war. And thankfully, he did come home in 1973 when the other POWs came home from Vietnam.
And so how long was he a POW?
I'm not sure of the exact number of years. I did call and talk to Sherry White in California to tell her I'd used her phrase as the title of my book. And she was surprised, but she sounded kind of pleased. He was a POW, I believe, for about 6 years, but I'm not sure of that exact time frame.
Because you were left not knowing, was he a POW? Was he killed? What happened to my husband? It was 19 and a half years before you found out from official sources. I'll put it that
yes,
way.
Official sources. Finally, when his remains came back in 1985, I did speak to his squadron members who came back about a month or 6 weeks after Mike's plane was shot down in Vietnam. That was September 30th, 1965. And I met with two of his best friends from the squadron who were stationed at Ubon, Thailand. They flew missions over North Vietnam on the bombing missions out of Thailand bases. And two of the men, John Harrington and Doug Conaway, met with me when the squadron came back, and they did say, Dana, Doug told me, Dana, I was in the plane right behind Mike, and I saw it. There's no way he got out. So he's not coming back walking in the door one day. Don't sit around and hope and wait, because I saw it, and I just want you to have a better life than sitting there not knowing. But it did take, as you said, 19 and a half years before his remains were returned to the United States with others in a grouping in April of 1985. So I finally got closure, as that's a wonderful word, when his remains were buried at Arlington National Cemetery April 16, 1985. So that was 19 and a half years, really, until I got a definitive, positive answer.
So in a way, you were better off than some other widows because you had an eyewitness who told you, Dana, I saw your husband's plane get hit. I saw the plane drop down, and there's no way, there were no survivors. So don't hope.
Yes, I was lucky in that strange, twisted sense of that, because there are families still today in 2016 who still hope and who still wait for word that their loved one, who served in Vietnam, has never been found or accounted for. So, yes, in a way, I was doubly blessed, as strange as this sounds, because when Mike's plane was shot down, I did not know that I was pregnant. And 6 months later, our wonderful daughter was born, and I named her after Michael, of course. I named her Michelle. So she's my wonderful anchor point for my life.
My guest is Dana Schwan, and she has written a semi-autobiographical book, The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows. And Dana, I'd like to go back to April 5th, 1985. This you cover in chapter 13 of your book. I want to jump chronologically to that chapter because you know, when I see what you describe in your book, when I see this in movies, it is so heart-wrenching just to see a movie depiction of a day like you experienced or your daughter experienced. So you start that chapter with a little article in the, you were living in Tampa, Florida, by the way, at that time, and you start with a, just a short, like a paragraph from the Tampa Tribune. Do you remember what the wording of that notice that you, and you clipped it out?
I did clip it out. I had that terrible habit of clipping out anything that pertained to Vietnam or the war or the missing in action. I clipped it out, and I had files and files and files. And I saw this little one-paragraph item. It was on March 19th, 1985, and it said, Vietnamese to return remains. And I wondered, well, who's getting to return home, and what families would now know about their loved ones' missing in action status? 1985, you see, the war was over in 1973, and that's when the POWs that Vietnam held were returned to us, and they denied knowledge of any other prisoners being held. At that time, there were almost 2,500 men who were still unaccounted for from Vietnam. So I read that little article.
Dana, for interrupting, because you do say in your book that those were the figures from the Pentagon count.
Yes.
And you think, and not just you, but others, that that official count of nearly 2,500 Americans unaccounted for in the Vietnam War was a low figure.
I do think it was a low figure because we had covert operations that were taking place with small bases in Laos, which adjoined Vietnam, and those people, a lot of them were missing, captured Some were killed, but they were never returned or accounted for. So there are many of us who believe there are still POWs, particularly in Laos, that were never returned or accounted for.
So this little article, this little article in the Tampa Tribune, this little paragraph, didn't go into what I just asked you about, but it did say that Vietnamese were going to be returning remains of our soldiers. And you clip it out because you clipped out all the articles that were related to that. And you had no idea that it was going to be personal.
I had no idea whatsoever. That was just absolutely the biggest shock about 3 weeks later when we were officially notified by the government that my husband's remains were being returned along with his front seater. There were two men in the plane. And another pilot's remains were being returned. So that was a really big shock, which the official way of doing things back in that time, in 1985, when remains were returned, is the protocol was that two Air Force officers or two service officers would go to the home of the family and make the announcement and hand them a letter, official stationary report from the government saying that your husband's remains or brother's or son's remains are being returned. And that's what happened to us. We were just living our lives, doing the best we could in Tampa, Florida. My daughter was in college, freshman in college. She was home that day. I was out for the afternoon with a friend, and two officers knocked on the door, and Michelle was getting ready to go to work as a cashier at Walgreens while she was in college. And she answered the door, and there were two Air Force officers there who handed her this letter, asked her to read it in their presence, sign a statement that they had hand-delivered it, and they sat and talked with her a few minutes because she was 19 years old. She had just turned 19 2 days before.
Mm-hmm. And so it was just 2 days after. 2 days after her birthday, here's this young 19-year-old. You happen to not be there. She's the only one there. And these two officers come in and give her this letter. And I just can't imagine what it must have been like for her.
It was so traumatic because she had always felt bereaved that she never knew her father. Her father never held her. She had no real connection other than photographs. And, of course, I would tell her stories and, you know, tell her about his personality and talk to her. But she had no direct connection with this man who was her father, although she has his looks and his little sleigh nose. And she looks very much like him, which is a blessing.
I was trying to imagine Michelle's reaction because you've said that wives – would dread that moment when an official car would drive up to their home. And you said sometimes they would faint seeing that car drive up.
Yes, we've heard that from several of the wives. Their knees would go weak, and they would just faint knowing that there were two officers approaching their door with very bad news. So Michelle, as a 19-year-old, was very mature. But she answered the door, and she was just overcome with emotion and started crying. I thought it was kind of them that they sat there with her and talked to her for quite some time until she calmed down. And I was still out with my friend, and so she called my mother to tell my mother, who also lived in Tampa, that her dad's remains were coming home. So by the time I got home several hours later, she greeted me at the door, and she had been on the phone. I could see her on the phone as I was walking up the sidewalk to my house with the windows, the way they were placed at our house. And I thought, well, the phone's for me, and I just brushed past her and picked up the phone. And it was my mother who said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Sure, I'm fine." And I looked down and saw this piece of paper on the kitchen counter. And Michelle was kind of standing off to the side looking at me very strangely.
You could tell it was a letter, but most letters come folded in an envelope. And you said that this letter didn't have creases in it. It hadn't been folded because it had been hand-delivered.
Right. And I thought, my goodness, how did this letter get here? And then when I read it and said, "Your husband's remains have been positively identified and are being returned to the United States," my knees got weak and I started shaking, and I could hardly stand up. I was just totally overcome with emotion about after 19 and a half years. It was just such a shock. I thought he would never come home. I thought the remains would be over in Vietnam forever. But I can tell you, the Vietnamese had stockpiled remains over the years as they recovered them, and they just kept doling out a few remains at the time as they wanted to influence world opinion that they were cooperating on the prisoner of war missing in action issues. So that's how many remains came home in small wood boxes, large enough to accommodate the bones, certainly not a coffin size. It just sounds kind of macabre for me to talk about this, but bones are bones. I just couldn't believe that my beautiful 6'2" man was coming home as a handful of bones and a few teeth. That's what happened. And I requested photographs of the remains, and I went over those pictures with a magnifying glass, and I counted the number of bones and bone fragments that were returned, and it was 47 pieces of bones, and that's all that was left of my beautiful serviceman.
My guest is Dana Schwan, and she has written a semi-autobiographical book, The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows. And she's been recounting the day that an official car drove up to her door in Tampa, Florida, and delivered a letter to her daughter. Dana happened not to be there at the time they delivered it. And when you arrived, you say your daughter Michelle was talking to your mother on the phone, and you bounce in, yeah, everything's fine, how are you doing, Mom? And then you see this letter. And you must have been just overwhelmed with, now what do I do? And one of the people you called was a guy named Marty Comer. Is that how he pronounces it, Comer?
Marty Comer, yes, he's one of my favorite vets in the Tampa area.
And why did you call him?
Well, he and I had become friends over the years after Mike's before Mike's remains came home. We had been friends for a long time. He was the president of the local Vietnam Veterans Group in Tampa. He started the state council to unite all the Vietnam veterans groups throughout the state of Florida. And I went to a lot of the conventions. I went to Tallahassee many times for programs. He helped me do prisoner of war missing in action public awareness events that we did all over the state, but mainly in the Tampa, St. Petersburg, Clearwater area, because there's so many veterans there with the Air Force Base.
Well, now, in the back of your book, you have various notes and photographs, and one of them is a picture of Marty Comer. You also, and this is a touching point you make, one of the photographs is a picture of your young husband sitting on this large sofa in your living room.
Yes.
And you say that you and your daughter sat together on that sofa, the same sofa that Mike had bought for our apartment in Tampa 20 years ago in 1965. And there it was, 1985. And you said you'd upholstered the sofa several times, but you couldn't bear to part with it because it was one of those links.
Yes. It was a link, and I guess it was just sentimental for me to keep the sofa, but it was very well made. And then after it was reupholstered, it looked absolutely great. And so it was kind of ironic that he had bought it for our apartment, as you say, back in the day in 1965, and here it was, 85, and Michelle and I are sitting in there talking. And it was a surreal time. It was a surreal evening. But I did call Marty, and Marty and I had befriended also one of the main reporters for UPI at the Tampa Tribune. And so Marty called our reporter friend, his name was Nash Stublin, who has since passed away. But Marty told him what was going on and asked Nash to call me in the morning and get some background and details for a news story.
Mm-hmm. So he could write a story for the Tampa Tribune.
Right.
So you say that on April 9th, so this was just a few days after you and Michelle got the letter, that they ran a front-page story with a photograph of you and Michelle.
Yes, they did, and that generated all kinds of wonderful, wonderful phone calls and letters and people coming over, and it generated a lot of interest because it was the first major event of a serviceman being missing in action and being whose remains were returned. So it did generate a lot of interest, and national media called, and it was just kind of like a circus for the next 2 or 3 days, and it was just heartwarming to see how many people cared. And I don't know if you know, but during the Vietnam War, when there were missing in action people, servicemen, people would order and wear a bracelet with that man's name on it and the date of his becoming missing, and people returned these bracelets to me. I got probably 15 or 20 back from people all over the country that had worn his bracelet and seen the news article, because it was picked up and run nationally on in several different big cities. Mm-hmm. But the bracelets, I still have bracelets, and I still occasionally on Memorial Day, Veterans Day, I will wear a bracelet for the father of a friend of mine who is still missing in action.
My guest is Dana Schwann, and we're talking about her book, The Reluctant Sorority, referring to Vietnam War widows. And you say that the Tampa Tribune, you were living in Tampa, Florida at the time, ran this front page full story with a color photograph of you and Michelle, your daughter Michelle. And you say the phone started ringing at 6:30 that morning.
Yeah.
And that you were hearing from friends and veterans and reporters from all over the country. The TV stations came over, and you say that it was kind of a media circus at that time. Then you mentioned these bracelets that people had sent to you that just were so touching. You said you felt tears of joy and relief and sadness that these people did and that wore his bracelets.
Right.
Now, you also, as you wrap up that chapter, you say, after you hung up the phone, you felt like there was a 10-pound weight on your heart that was no longer there.
I actually felt physically different, lighter. It was, and I didn't even know that I had been so, quote, weighted down over Mike's loss. But after I got the word and the news, it lifted, and it just was a wonderful feeling to no longer be burdened with that unknowing.
Yeah, you said, and so this was the first time since September the 30th of 1965, this April of 1985, was the first time that you felt that lightness. You felt physically lighter, like that 10-pound weight had been lifted from your heart.
Right.
Then you have to decide the issue of, okay, now that I have his remains, now what? And I did notice, and I don't know if you realized you did this on purpose or it just came out that way, when you were writing this book, because you're telling the story of three different wives, you refer to your part of the story, you use third person. You say, Dana, this happened, and this happened to Dana. Except this chapter 13, when you say, I. So I was wondering so I assume that everything in this chapter was absolutely followed fact, was true.
Yes.
Because you do use your imagination for a lot of the stories, obviously, of the other widows. But this chapter, everything in it was based on your experiences.
Well, you're very observant, Nancy, and I did not realize I had done that until Michelle was reading through the manuscript before we had it printed. And she goes, Mom, why is that in the first person and the others are in the third person? I says, I don't know. That's just the way I wrote it. Leave it alone.
Yeah, because then you switch back to referring to your things that happened to Dana as Dana. But that chapter 13, you say, I, and tell it from the first person.
Well, you're very observant, honey.
Well, let's go back now to the time that your story starts, as far as when you met Mike and what your life was like in that very short time that you had a life together. Where were you when you met Mike?
Well, I met Michael at a party in an apartment complex on Davis Island in Tampa, Florida, and that was near the base where a lot of the pilots lived in these apartment complexes. That's where I met him, and we had a whirlwind courtship, and it was just a wonderful time. I mean, I was 23, he was 25. Oh, no, he had just turned 26. I met him right after his 26th birthday. And it was just a whirlwind of fun and activity and parties and going here and there and sleeping in the car on the beach at night and watching the sunrise come up. You know, it was just a wonderful, exciting time. And the pilots are just a breed unto themselves. They're just cocky and cocksure, and they strut and they don't walk. It's really funny. They're such great guys, and they're super intelligent. They usually have a great sense of humor. And we just had a wonderful, idyllic time for the short time we were together before he had to ship out in July of 1965. So it was a whirlwind. We met right after his birthday in October of 64, got married in February. He left in July. I went to go be a stewardess to have something fun to do while he was gone. He was only supposed to be gone 90 days.
Now, wait a minute. Let's go back. You said you decided to be a stewardess.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting choice because you said you've done a lot of things. You've been an English high school English teacher. But here was you had a husband who was a pilot who flew airplanes, and you choose to be. And in those days, being a stewardess, that was a pretty fun job to have.
Well.
And they didn't take just anybody. So you were a part of a select group of young women.
Well, yes. I chose to do that with Mike's blessing. He says, go do something fun. I'm only going to be gone 90 days. Go do something fun. And so I said, well, I've always wanted to be a stew. He said, well, go do it. I mean, this was before the days of flight attendant phraseology.
Yeah, you were a stewardess in those days.
Yeah, so I chose to go with Northwest Orient Airlines, which was based out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, because it was a change from Tampa, Florida, the humidity and the heat. And it would be something different to do while he was gone for fun. And so I did that, except I kept getting airsick.
Oh, no, now a lot of people get airsick, and particularly in those days, you had the bag on the back seat. But you also said that your daughter was born 6 months after Mike left. So maybe there was another reason you were feeling a little queasy.
Yes.
Maybe you didn't know that, though, when you were first flying, when you first made your first flights as a stewardess. Did you think it was just air sickness?
I thought it was just air sickness and being nervous. And, I hadn't flown that much, for heaven's sakes. But I really did not know I was pregnant. I did not know. So that was the joy and the blessing of even my short whirlwind life and time with Michael is that I have Michelle.
My guest is Dana Schwann, and she has written a semi-autobiographical book, The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows. And so far, we've just talked about your experiences, and your book does cover three other widows from different backgrounds. And so I want to talk to you. I want to find out more about these other characters now, because I think they are mostly from your imagination, but you have documentation that makes me think these characters, these other women, were based on real people, at least the Russian lady.
They were real people in my mind, and they would come to me and talk to me. I know this sounds woo-woo, but in my dream time and sleep time at night, I would have dreams about these women who wanted their stories told. So I thought, wow, I wasn't the only one, and Americans weren't the only one that were harmed and damaged and their lives affected so drastically by war. So I incorporated and wove the story of a Vietnamese woman and the Russian woman in my story all together.
Well, I want to hear more about them, but we are going to take a short break. And
okay.
When we get back, I want to hear more about these other two characters, other two widows in your book.
Happy to tell you. Okay.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, host of Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I've been talking to author Dana Schwann, who is an advocate for public awareness on the issue of POWs and MIAs. Her book is The Reluctant Sorority, and in her book, she describes, recounts the life, loves, and loss of three Vietnam War widows. Dana herself had a husband, he was in the Air Force. He was a pilot who was shot down over North Vietnam, and she has told us about the day that an official car drove up to her front door with a letter saying that it was official now that her husband was dead and that his remains would be arriving. So your story, and I mentioned that chapter 13 you tell in the first person because that all of that was true that happened to you. But you say these other characters came to you and told you their stories. Since you mentioned that, Dana, I noticed some paranormal elements in your story, and I'd like to give you a chance to describe that because this is not, it may be hard for some people to believe, but you often hear that a mother, say, whose son is killed in war on a battlefield on the other side of the world, and she suddenly wakes up in the middle of the night and says, oh my goodness, my son's just been killed.
Yeah.
And you have hints of that. For example, the Vietnamese woman had a dream that her husband was not going to come back when he left her to go off to war. She dreamed that he would not come back.
Yes.
And then the Russian lady, her husband, Anatoly happened to be her husband's name, he hoped that somehow she was tuned into him and would feel the love he sent to her.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of people that would understand that, but it does seem a little on the, I think you use the term woo-woo side for some people to believe. But the one I want you to tell us about is involved your brother. You have a brother named Paul.
Yes.
And he had only met Mike just not too long before Mike left. So what happened? What happened to your brother, Paul?
My brother Paul met Mike in March when we went up to South Georgia, Quitman, my hometown. And we had a family reunion, and Mike and I went there. We had a wonderful meeting with my parents and my other brother, John, and relatives in the area of Quitman. And Mike and Paul had a good visit and rapport. And then when Mike went overseas, Paul would write me a letter every now and then. How are you doing, sis, little sis? What's happening? And so I would keep him apprised of Mike's letters to me. And one night when Paul was just getting ready to go to bed, but he hadn't gone to sleep yet, he turned out the light, and he saw Mike's plane take a hit. He saw it. And then he heard Mike say, Babes, which was his nickname for me. And so Paul got out of bed, turned on the light, and he was just stunned because he'd never had any kind of vision or anything like this before. He just didn't even know what to make of it. He couldn't believe it, but he knew what he saw. Psychically, he saw the airplane take a hit, and he heard Mike's voice say, Babes. So he sat in a chair almost the rest of the night because he just couldn't go back to sleep. He couldn't go to sleep. And so he didn't tell me about this until years later because he didn't want to be the one to tell me that he knew Mike was coming back.
And this, what was the date of this vision that your brother had in the middle of the night?
The date would have been October 1st, and Mike's plane was shot down September 30th, but then there's the international dateline in between. Mm-hmm. So he said he would just have to wait and see what transpired, what happened, if I had any news from Mike. And then I got news about Mike just a few days later, and that's when I called him. And he never told me that until several years afterwards. Yeah. That he had that vision.
You say your brother at the time was living in Columbia, South Carolina, and
right.
This last thought that Mike had, you said, was received in Columbia, South Carolina at the instant it was sent. And the receiver was your brother, Paul. And he was, you can imagine if he'd never had visions before, never heard voices, and he hears Mike's voice, he sees the plane take a hit and dive and was crashed. And of course, I'm sure he thought, oh, that's just a bad dream. But it upset him enough that he didn't want to upset you, so he didn't tell you about this vision and this and the fact that he heard Mike's voice.
Mm-hmm. He did not.
But he knew that Mike had died almost instantly, and there was no chance he was a POW.
Right.
Yeah. My guest is Dana Schwann, and in her book, The Reluctant Sorority, she describes what happens in the lives of three Vietnam War widows. The American widow, she draws on her own experiences to describe what happened to an American widow. But then I mentioned, too, there is a Vietnamese widow and a Russian widow. Now, the Vietnamese widow, we know, I mean, the war is taking place in Vietnam. So we kind of expect, so there's a Vietnamese war widow, but a Russian war widow? Where did that come from?
Well, that came from out of the blue in a fought one day, and it was like there actually were Russian soldiers who fought with the North Vietnamese Army, and there were advisors from Russia for the North Vietnam artillery people, but the actual artillery guns many times were manned by the Russians, and 3,000 Russians marched and advocated for acknowledgement of their services in Vietnam within recent years. But anyway,
Want to make the point, too, since part of your book is fictional, that this is actual fact that you're telling us now about the role of the Russians in the Vietnam War.
Yes, the Russians were actively involved in fighting and in shooting down American aircraft, and they even got awards and medals for how many aircraft they shot down. But it occurred to me as I was writing the book and putting down my thoughts of what I wanted to contain in the book, the Russian people suffered too, for their servicemen got killed. Not very many of them, but there were Russian deaths in Vietnam on the side of the Vietnamese. So I just wanted to have a broader scope and pull in the Russian female character and the Vietnamese female character, because we're all the same. When a serviceman dies, no matter what his nationality is, his wife, his children, his siblings, his parents, everybody suffers for the loss of a serviceman in war, which is why I've become such an advocate for peace and how insane war is to keep sending our best and brightest young people to fight other wars in countries that where our national interest is not affected. We have no business being there. So I've just become a big peacenik, I guess you would say, and an advocate against war.
Well, and you take somebody who grows up in the culture who was our enemy. The Russians, the Soviets were our enemy.
Yes.
And yet you tell a story, a very human story. Here's a young woman, young like you were, and she suddenly finds herself without her husband.
Exactly. Yes.
So how did...
he was doing his duty. The Vietnamese soldier was doing his duty. Mike was doing his duty as what he was ordered to do. So they died in service believing in the cause for which they were fighting. They were believing that their service would make a difference.
So you start your story of Neva. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Neva, yes.
N-E-V-A. Uh-huh. It's in April. It was just an ordinary day. It was cold and rainy. And she woke up to get to go to work. And what kind of work did you have her do?
She worked as a secretary in the in one of the big art cultural departments, a government position. And she was bright, and I saw her as being blonde and blue-eyed and beautiful. And I saw the Vietnamese as being a slender woman with two children who later were killed by a bomb. And I saw these characters, and that's why I included them, because we're all the same. We've all faced a loss. And what I was kind of thinking of is the wonderful, wonderful movies, Dr. Zhivago, Titanic, Dances with Wolves. Those are three of my favorite movies. They all have fictional characters, but they're based in historical fact of events that happened. You see, true events that happen, but fictional characters. And I thought, heck, I can do that. And that's why I wove them into my story.
Well, you have your character, your Russian widow, suffers a double blow. And was that based on any kind of fact? Because she, first, she lost her husband, Anatoly. And then she lost her parents, both of them, just a short time after that. You had them die in a train crash. And I wondered what gave you the idea of having her parents die in a train crash.
Well, I had to use a device to free her up to get her to America. And she wouldn't come to America and leave her aging parents there. But there was an article in the Tampa Tribune about a Russian train wreck that caused so many deaths. And I thought, aha, that's the perfect device to use to free Neva and get her out of Russia so she could come to America and be an interpreter at the embassy in Washington, D.C., which is where the wall is. And that's where she bumped into me one morning, you see, in my mind, in my fictional makeup part of the story here, because I love the wall. The wall is so meaningful to me and the other widows and service people and the men that serve. They go and they find their buddies' names on the wall. It's so important.
Well, I do want to get back to your Russian lady, though,
and
the fact that you saw this article in the Tampa Tribune about a train crash.
Yep.
And that's the sort of thing, in the back of your book, you have photographs and Xerox copies of things that explain notes, that explain your book. And so you do have this reproduction of the article you see in the Tampa Tribune about this train crash that gives you the idea, I'll have this character lose her parents, so then she's free to start a new life by going to the United States. And so you have a Xerox copy of in August of 1988, this train derailment kills 22 traveling to Moscow. And so if this is August 1988, so this is when you were writing your book. When did that's this idea arrive? Because you got the word that your husband's remains were being sent back. This was 1985. And when did you start getting this notion, I'm going to write a book?
I started that in 1988. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened, see, I had that bad habit of clipping out little newspaper articles. And that one caught my eye because I just thought that my story alone is not going to make any difference. I'm only one of thousands of widows. I'm one of thousands. But here's the Vietnamese I brought in and the Russian I brought in to tie it all together, to make it a broader impact.
My guest is Dana Schwann, and she is an advocate for the issue of public awareness of the issue of POWs and MIAs, and she travels around giving talks, speaking at candlelight vigils for bringing awareness to the Vietnam veterans and their plight and missing in action. You have been telling us about this Russian widow who's young like you are. Now tell us about the character that you have as a widow in Vietnam.
Okay, I named her Melon. She told me that was her name in a dream one night. I just based her on imagination of what it would be like to be a young widow living in poor circumstances in rural Vietnam, out from Hue, which was a very high cultural city with a lot of art museums and culture. It was an intellectual center in Vietnam.
So I might contrast her circumstances, being poor Vietnamese, with the Russian character widow that you describe as being quite well off because her parents owned a dacha, and so she has the means, unlike this poor Vietnamese lady.
Yes.
And so to continue with Melon.
Yes. Melon, I had her make her way to Saigon, where her sister had already relocated to because there was so much fighting in the north part of the country. And then I had the two of them get Mei-Lan's youngest child out of Vietnam on the last day when the Americans were abandoning Vietnam and flying out, and everybody was panicking what to do. And Mei-Lan and her sister stayed behind, but they got her young son on the last one of the last flights out to America when Americans were evacuating the orphanages, mainly of Vietnamese American children who had been fathered by servicemen but were not welcomed by the society of Vietnam. So they had to be, they wanted the children called children of the death, fathered by American servicemen, out of the country so that they would have a better life. Otherwise, they would be starving and street urchins. So,
And one of the photographs you have in your book shows these Vietnamese orphans on a plane being airlifted out of Saigon in April of 1975, before Saigon fell.
Yes.
And there's just row after row of these little tiny babies. And you say this was Operation Baby Lift.
Yes, that really happened. That really happened, and they were sent to families all over the United States that wanted to adopt these children. And then I had the fictional child named New come to me in Tampa, Florida. So it just the story wove itself together. It was just supposed to be.
Well, and he also, this young man, had in common what Michelle did in that he never saw his father because he was born after his father disappeared.
Exactly, yes.
And you say this character told you about themselves.
They did. They would come to me in my dream time while I was at night, and they would tell me their stories, and they wanted their stories told. So I'm the willing servant to weave it all together, and that's what happened. But my story is called A Faction, and it weaves fact and fiction together. And this is now a genre of writing that's being taught in colleges. It's called faction.
Yeah, and that's the way historical novels work. And you, when you start with the very last chapter, you say that this book was 48 years in the making, but 25 years in the writing of it.
Now, yes.
It took you 25 years to write this this book.
I'm very slow. I just got distracted by life and doing all my projects and traveling, and I would write a little bit here and there, and then other things would come to mind and be developed, and it did take that long to actually put it all together. So,
well, you mentioned that you developed these three characters. One was based on your own life, and then these two others, and you have them eventually, these their stories come together. And you mentioned earlier, you referred to the wall in Washington,
yes.
D.C.
Yes.
And I remember, Dana, when the artist was chosen to create this memorial, that there were a lot of people who were dissatisfied. They didn't like her idea. They didn't like the way it was going to be executed. What was the controversy about the Vietnam Memorial Wall, the Vietnam Memorial?
People have this idea that there have to be statues and it has to be a big deal. And her simple design of black marble with only the names is absolutely perfect, because that's all that matters is the names of the men who served and were lost. There are eight women's names on the wall. They were nurses who were killed actively involved in Vietnam in their duties.
So there's no ranking, they're just names, and chronologically listed.
They're chronological by date of death, and that way you can, if you know the date that they died, or you don't even have to, there are guides there with books that tell you what name is on what panel, because the panels are numbered and the lines are numbered, so you can find who you're looking for. But the controversy back in the day when this design was unanimously accepted by all of these judges, or not unanimous, but overwhelmingly accepted and appointed that this was the winner. That it was a black gash of shame, and it was below ground, and how, you know, awful that someone would even think this would be a suitable memorial. Well, now it's the most visited memorial in the United States, I mean, in Washington, D.C., because people come to see the names of people they loved, and that's what's important.
Well, and you reproduce a letter that you have your character, because at that point in the story, you're referring to Dana as a in the third person. So you have a letter that Dana wrote and left there at the wall. And I'm assuming this was true. You must have written this letter. Is that true?
That is true. I wrote that letter, and I have left several letters. When I've been in Washington at the wall, I've left several letters. And through leaving one there 1 year, the two daughters of Bill Andrews tracked me down and found me because I left a letter in front of his panel on the wall to say Bill Andrews remembered and loved still, Dana Schwann, Tampa, Florida. They found me at the convention I was at, and I have visited them in their home in Phoenix on two different occasions. It's just been an incredible thing because Bill Andrews was a roommate for my husband Michael Schwann before we got married in Tampa. So as you see, it's just all these wonderful coincidences.
Well, when people go to this wall, I've never been myself, but I just can imagine how emotional that moment is to see your loved one's name carved in black marble. And you left a letter, but what happens then? You can't just leave things like that there forever. The wall, the space would be just inundated. So what happens to these? What else is left besides? You left a letter.
I left a letter. People leave photographs. People leave baby shoes. People leave combat boots. People leave medals that they have earned. All of these items are gathered up every night by the Park Service, and they are housed in a warehouse. And one researcher, author, who found my letter in the warehouse, she was riffling through a whole bunch of stuff, and she found my letter. She called me in Tampa, and she included my letter in her book.
These mementos are left on the wall. What was the role of a gentleman named Jan Scruggs?
Jan Scruggs had the concept to memorialize people, his friends who had died in Vietnam. He didn't want their names to be forgotten, and he had the concept to have a wall built. But he did not. He just wanted a design and a memorial. He didn't have the concept of the black marble or the names in chronological order. He just knew he wanted a memorial built in Washington to honor Vietnam veterans. And the thing is, it is the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial. It is not the Vietnam Memorial, which many people call it. But anyway, I'm so thankful. In March of 2015, I got to meet Jan Scruggs here in Santa Fe when he was here, when a half-scale replica of a wall that travels around the country to different communities was here in Santa Fe. I got to meet and talk with Jan Scruggs for about 5 minutes. He's one of my heroes.
My guest is Dana Schwann, and we're talking about her semi-autobiographical book, The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows. After, this was in February of 2014, a columnist for the Rochester Independent newspaper, who had been an Air Force pilot, he flew combat missions over North Vietnam, he lost his best friend over North Vietnam, and he wrote an article about your book, and he ends his article, Dana, he says, "Never forget, never forgive, and never believe a politician." And when I read that, I thought, now that really is a contrast from the way Dana wrote her book. He sounds bitter. Never forget, never forgive, never believe a politician. I don't see and hear and read bitterness in your story, Dana.
No, I'm not bitter. I am not bitter because it's life. It's what happened. I can't change it. I had to accept it. Like I said, that 10-pound weight on my heart left.
Well, you also
are not bitter.
You also you appreciate the Air Force because you say they are exemplary in their treatment of MIA wives.
They have been outstanding. They have treated us, the MIA widows and wives and those who were lost, they have treated us exceedingly well. They are generous on the phone with their phone time. If you can call and ask them anything, and they are just courteous, they treat us wonderfully well, or have treated us wonderfully well. So I'm grateful for that.
And there is the other side of that coin that you say the Pentagon doesn't acknowledge past misinformation. And I don't want to get into that, but maybe you have books for people who are interested. Maybe you could recommend books for people who want to read about that.
There are two outstanding books that tell the story from the perspective of the missing in action. One is a fantastic researcher. She has just passed away, but she did the most dynamic book. It's called Abandoned in Place. Her name is Lynn O'Shea. Abandoned in Place is documents and documents. She is a fantastic researcher. The book is excellent. The other most important book is An Enormous Crime, and that's written by the daughter of a friend of mine, a daughter of a pilot who is still missing in action, Peter Stewart, and a former congressman, Bill Hendon. So Bill Hendon helped to write this book with Elizabeth Stewart, an MIA daughter. And the book is An Enormous Crime. Both of those books are excellent. If anybody wants to know the true story about the POW-MIA issue and how it's been bungled, and the American people has been misled by government and Pentagon people.
Well, Dana, before we finished our conversation with each other, I do want to mention something that has really nothing to do with our topic, but you did say that you went to a family reunion. You and Mike went to Quitman, Georgia. That's a little town just in southern Georgia. And Facebook notified me about, well, they had some pictures of this hometown of classes, and I found out through somebody that we both know that you had written this book, and you wrote back and said that you actually remember my younger brother because you babysat my younger brother in this little town in Georgia back way a long time ago. So it's been wonderful renewing acquaintances and having this conversation with Dana, and I want to congratulate you on this book.
Thank you, my dear.
The book is The Reluctant Sorority, The Life, Loves, and Loss of Three Vietnam War Widows. The author is Dana Schwan. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.